The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. If you read Darius James's 1992 masterpiece, Negrophobia, An Urban Parable, when it was initially published, you know the book is an over-the-top, hypersexualized, and hilarious dystopian satire and indictment of the many faces and forms of American racism. Paul Beatty, the author of The Sellout, calls James's book luridly funny, unsparingly smart. Negrophobia is an American arcana of the highest order, and like all truly cool books, destined forever to be ahead of its time. So a hat tip to New York Review Books Classics for bringing this contemporary classic back into print for the next generation to marvel at. Darius James's other works include That's Blaxploitation, Roots of the Badass Tude, Voodoo Stew, and Froggy Chocolate's Christmas Eve. He is also the co-writer and narrator of the 2013 film, The United States of Hoodoo, which you can download and enjoy for a nominal fee on Vimeo. To those of you who haven't read Negrophobia, please be aware that we are a First Amendment shop here at the old FLP. As James writes in the preface, this book is not a safe space. It is loaded with triggers, and I hope it gives you nightmares. In short, listener discretion is advised. Tonight, Darius James will be in conversation with Gene Seymour, contributor to The Nation and former film critic and jazz columnist for Newsday, where he is still a special contributor. Gene has also written for Book Forum, CNN.com, and The Washington Post. You can find his latest analyses of the culture at GeneSeymour.com. It's my honor and a pleasure to welcome both Darius James and Gene Seymour to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
I'm just going to say for myself that this was this book came out. I brought my own original copy, first edition, autographed, and I'm going to ask about the autograph first thing. But you ever get those feelings that there's some books where you know, they come across your consciousness, and on the one hand, you wished you'd written it yourself, and on the other hand, you say to yourself, you know, why didn't this exist before now? And that was the first of many shocks to the system that this book administered. And over time, we're going to get into just what constitutes those shocks, but I thought I would start by asking about the inscription you put in this book. You probably don't even remember what you wrote. But what you wrote was, subvert now for the future. Now again, this was 1991. It is now 2019. It is the future. So So let's start by asking, what do you think has been subverted or not subverted enough for this future that we're in right now?
What do I think? I'm obviously at the time, and this one. You know, I think it's important to lay the seeds for change, transformation. Subversion, for me, isn't simply the distortion of a condition, situation, reality, whatever, but it's about growth, it's about change. And that, you know, clearly I saw an imminent danger, you know, headed our way. And this was my attempt to subvert that danger.
What now? Define the danger. What was the danger?
Basically, you know, I was writing about racism. I was trying to talk about the the sort of sick psychology involved with racism and a lot of the unconscious content of racism.
Yeah.
And I was hoping to at least get people to look at it by confronting their own, you know, what might be the racist aspects of their own psychology, and to liberate themselves through laughter.
Yeah, because as you say, and as has been already said, this book contains many, many triggers, and they're all aimed at you. No matter who you are, where you come from, or what your own presumptions are, they all get pointed at you and demand much from you in terms of your own confrontation with what these stereotypes, archetypes, or whatever stories trigger in you as a reaction. And the first thing I want to talk about as far as that goes is the time in which it was written, the early 90s. And was there anything specific in that time, or maybe non-specific of that era, that made you decide, okay, now's the time to start firing?
I was thinking about this over the last couple of weeks, and where negrophobia actually came from was a sort of trauma that I and a lot of other people experienced growing up in the 60s in terms of Birmingham and the fire hosings, the dogs, looking at photographs of Emmett Till's crisp corpse.
How old were you when you saw that?
Oh, we're talking like 6, 7,
wow.
8 years old.
Okay, yeah.
And as you know, as children,
yeah,
you know, we had the experience of watching Amos and Andy on TV and the Little Rascals with the now censored episodes, Inky and the Minor Bird cartoons, Warner Brothers racist cartoons,
right.
But rather than take those images personally, we actually made fun of them, you know, in our interactions with each other, you know. And I know that those images upset a lot of people. However, I felt that if you like correctly identify those images as something that was the product of someone else's imagination and not you, that possibly others could learn from the experience of laughter.
Yeah. It's very hard to feel, I mean, I think for many people who, and I'm in the same generation as you, who grew up with these images, who grew up with a lot of the bigotry and all the stuff that sort of was in the air for most of our young lives and our adult lives, finding the permission, finding the being enabled to take those images and push them back after they've been thrown at you all your life is a big step. And was there anything or anyone specifically that gave you the permission to sort of fire back?
Ishmael Reed.
Yeah.
Ishmael Reed made fun of things, in terms of black cultural intelligentsia that seemed taboo, and the fact that he could, I forget the novel, but there was a scene he wrote that took place on the campus of Berkeley with these African booksellers and incense salesmen.
Right. That was the last days of Louisiana Red.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And he portrayed them as sort of this Amos and Andy routine.
Yep.
Now, on the one hand, you know, because of the controversy surrounding Amos Nandy at the time, you would think of it as a racist, stereotypical, blah, blah, blah. But also, it had its foot in black cultural entertainment. A lot of black entertainers performed that way. In fact, Amos and Andy were the products of two black vaudevillians whose characters were stolen from them by Charles
Goodson and Friedman.
Goodson
and Charles Carell, I think they're
right.
Names were. Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
it was, yeah. Lyle,
right,
or Lyle and somebody else.
Yeah.
You know, so that's a tricky area, and I like that actually. Yeah.
I was also remembering. I don't know. Did you ever listen to the Busboys?
Yeah.
They were a new age rock. They were a kind of a, I guess you call it, punk rock era.
Yeah, the new wave.
New wave rock, yeah. And they took a lot of those stereotypes. I mean, they portrayed themselves as basically busboys. They were rock and roll. They dressed in uniform, and they threw a lot of that stuff back in the faces of their audiences. Most of those audiences were white audiences, and this was, I think they were probably taken aback, and it was, but there's something liberating about that seizure,
right?
You know? And you probably felt that energy too.
Yeah, I still do.
Yeah. You were a product of a very special time in New York culture, literary culture. What's been called, or known by some, the Lower East Side era of the early 90s, in art, literature, whatever. Could you sort of describe just what the energies were like that sort of helped contribute to your empowerment to put this book out? Is there something about that scene that did that?
That's hard. That's actually kind of hard to describe because I wasn't really living anywhere. I was living this kind of freewheeling bohemian lifestyle. Didn't have an apartment, crashed on people's couches. And I was caught up in the energy of the scene, like going out every night, getting completely blasted. And art was very much a part of that in terms of the gallery openings and the concerts and things like that. And there were lots of drugs. It was a lot of fun. However, one of the things that I and many others neglected to see was that artists were being used as a tool by real estate developers and speculators. You know, bring in the artists, and then you would attract the moneyed folks, and the moneyed folks would see these fine, like, loft spaces and things and buy them right from under you, and, like, the rents would go up in the neighborhood, and the traditional people who lived there were, like, moved out, you know, thus contributing to our
present
problem with homelessness, racism, things like that. I mean, I was out of Lower East Side for a bunch of years, living in Berlin, because I saw one of the reasons why I left the U.S. is because I saw the kinds of changes occurring in the so-called art scene, where people weren't so much interested in producing their art as they were like being sponsored by corporate entities and getting gallery shows. They were interested in being famous, you know, as opposed to doing good work and trying to say something. That was part of what that scene was like.
Right.
What was interesting for me was that the particular group of people that I hung out with were equally disenchanted with our social, cultural, and political realities. And we talked specifically about how to change the environment so people could create, so people could live, you know, not necessarily artists, not necessarily artists, but regular people, you know, basically the priorities, you know, the agenda that's being promoted nowadays by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Yes.
Okay. Her. In your introduction to the new edition, you refer to some of the reaction you got initially.
Mm-hmm.
I'm especially amused, particularly these days, by the fact that Bill Cosby didn't want that book to enter the doors of whatever house he happened to occupy. Number one, how did you hear about that? And number two, what kind of other reaction did you get from perhaps similar spheres, but overall, to the two that you were doing?
The Bill Cosby story I got from my cousin who was going to Howard, who attended Howard with Cosby's daughter.
Uh-huh.
And she told me the story.
Uh-huh.
I'm not saying it's true or not true. I'm simply like relaying the story that was told to me by my cousin, who seemed fairly reliable at the time.
But about the other reaction, I mean, what kinds of other? How did this land immediately at the time? I know how it affected me, but how did it affect others?
Actually, the response to the book was like overwhelmingly good, I thought. I mean, there were people who treated it like I can't come up with the metaphor of not touching it, that, you know, it was, so there were rumors that it was being sold in certain bookstores in like brown paper wrapper, that kind of thing, an undercover item. I don't know. I never had that experience of going into a bookstore. I mean, there were people who would not carry the book. Fine. You know, they had their agenda that they were trying to fill, but it was getting into the hands of enough people, you know. I read in Idaho. I was there for a week, and I did a series of readings. And I was reading in a bookstore near Camp Hayden. Hayden Camp, it was like, you know, some white supremacist paramilitary like camp, and you know, obviously my audience in this bookstore was all white, and I sat and talked with them, and I told them what my book was about, and blah blah blah, and they understood, and they understood why I was there, and we got along fine, and actually I sold every single copy of the book that I had in the store.
Not that you know the answer to this question, but I'd love to know who booked you there. I mean, what kind of imagination would have taken for them to send you to that place?
I've been trying to find. She retired. She was. She owned a lecture bureau. Her name was Arlene Greenbaum. She no longer exists because I've been trying to find her. I love doing those kinds of gigs and the kind of thing I'm trying to put together now. I could use someone to book me.
Okay, well, this is a challenge for all of you. If you know of any place like that where this could go down easily, by all means, you know, send him, send me, whatever. Okay, you have also written about blaxploitation. I think my first encounter with your work professionally was with That's Blaxploitation, which talks about the movies of the 70s. And it was probably one of the first serious or quasi-serious examinations of that era. And again,
I'm glad you recognize that. Who was it? There was some. I think he was teaching at Harvard at some point.
Don Bogle?
Not Don Bogle. He was teaching at Harvard. He did a documentary on black exploitation films.
Okay, I remember. Yeah, I know you're talking about. Yeah.
It just so happened that I was in Vienna when he screened the film.
I see.
And he got before the audience and said, this is the first time ever, ever anyone has dealt with this subject. And I happened to be in the audience, and he was rather surprised.
You did, did you?
He said that, and I confronted him, and then the organizers of this particular event told me to shut up.
Briefly, if you do not know the book, by the way, it not only has really unusual and to this day unique perspective on these movies, but you interview a lot of the people who were stars of those movies, like Pam Grier. We were talking about Antonio Fargas, which some of you remember from Starsky and Hutch and other places. But it's a good book to look up. And I'm
Melvin Van Peebles.
Melvin Peebles. Melvin Movies, as his son called
him.
Yeah. And again, this has become, and that sort of was also a landmark when these movies stopped being regarded as kind of exploitation fodder and taken seriously as a generational influence, artistically.
Okay. There are a few things involved in that particular book. One, I was pretty cynical after Negrophobia was published. I realized that, and this is no insult to the librarians, we should all value them. they're like the heart of this planet's soul. But when you're talking about commercial publishers, books are essentially toilet paper. They're to be sold, okay? And I had expected something different. I don't know what, but it wasn't actually what happened. Although, I got a lot of great critical feedback. I was still broke. I needed... the reason why people ask for large advances is not because they are necessarily greedy, but they will have the funds that will help support them while they write their next project. There were a lot of people in the industry who showed interest in that regard, but never came through. And I essentially got disgusted with the whole thing and left the country where I was better supported.
I think it's time now for you to actually pick out a section to read if you want to, or do you want to go on with something else?
I wasn't sure I answered your question.
You kind of did.
Yeah.
You kind of did.
The generational influence. That was one thing, my disenchantment with publishing. The next was the fact that actually the black exploitation films was kind of a switcheroo. The thing was put the films out there because people might be interested in the films of that period, but actually what I was interested in doing was talking about the kinds of teenage values I grew up with. Influences. For me was the Black Panther Party. Whereas at the time I wrote the book, the interest, the influence seemed to be the Nation of Islam. And I wanted to see things, I was hoping the book would steer things in the direction of the revolutionary philosophies of the Panther Party. And we're simply talking about ideologies, not necessarily actions. That was a lot of the reasoning behind the book.
Okay, gotcha. All right. Anyway, I think you wanted to read something, if you want.
Sure. Okay. I'm just going to give you a taste from the book, something that's not... too complicated. Okay. Negrophobia, which means fear of Negroes, is about the negrophobia of the character Bubbles Brazil. This this white blonde bombshell punk who uses some of her maids. She lives on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and she has a maid. And her maid practices of various hoodoo tricks, okay? And Bubbles, trying to shield herself against these bothersome Negroes in the high school she goes to, anoints her face with this face paint, you know, and the maid reacts, asks her where she got it from. You know, she learned it from her hoodoo books. Anyway, and so basically, maid puts a counterspell on her, and like all of her racist visions come to life, that, you know, she has to confront her fears, right?
By the way, it's Donald Goins High School that she attends, in case you were wondering. Yeah.
I could read that. But what I'm going to read is, which seems unfortunate that I only have time to read that, is the Disney sequence. And, okay, where do we start? Okay, this is it. Interior, the Disney Magic Mall. Bluebirds circle the spires of Sleeping Beauty Castle. A stylized yellow sun with laugh-wrinkled eyes whistles in a cartoon sky. Musical cymbals pop from its puckered lips. An elevated monorail hums through the caverns of the multi-leveled mall. The monorail stops and the two mouse-eared space boys hop aboard. Tilt down to mechanical puppets singing, "It's a Small World" in a woodland campfire tableau. The freckled, rosy-cheeked white child puppets in Nazi-esque Mickey Mouse uniforms click their boot heels and fling straight arm salutes around a naked, skewered, and trussed Negro roasting in the campfire's flame. A large red apple is lodged in his mouth. Okay. The United States, hold on a second. Okay. Having armed and organized themselves into an efficient paramilitary units in the second decade of the 21st century, the forces of white supremacy finally claim victory in their war on the hordes of lascivious mongrels in the American homelands. After a ruthless campaign of mass terror, brown shirt brutality, and outright assassination, the white supremacist army won public sympathy to their cause by evoking the holy names of God and his only son, claiming their actions were for the overall white Christian good. It was in the spirit of white Christian goodness that the endless song, or final solution, was put into effect. The United States' Second Civil War in the 21st century had reduced the nation to a vast boneyard of ruinated cities and extirpated lives. But far below the city's rubble was another world, a world blinded by fairy dust and cheap sleight-of-hand tricks. A world populated by cantankerous ducks and talking mice. A world with the holographic signs promising low, low prices and bargains galore. An underworld fun world for children of all ages. A live-in shopping world for the whole family. A Disney world. Cut to high-definition television screen in the spherical shapes of Mickey M's face. The screen crackles in a blizzard of snow, static, and white noise, which recedes into a blip. The television broadcasts a picture of Sleeping Beauty Castle at night, a fireworks display bursting above its battlements. Doe-eyed, busty, and swathed in leaves, Tinkerbell flutters on screen in a trail of pixie dust, waving her wand. The U.S. presidential seal appears in a ring of radiant concentric circles, its eagles replaced by Mickey M's face. The on-screen caption reads, "A special announcement for the United States President for life." Tinkerbell grasps the folds of her translucent wings, curtsies, and flies away with the grace of a hummingbird. The castle drawbridge lowers across the moat with the rasp of rusted chains. A glass coffin slides from the mouth of the castle in a bed of dry ice. His frosted lid creaks open. A man dressed in a conservative blues suit with icicles encasing his head like a bowl of porcupine quills rises from the coffin. The prickled ice ball turns to slush and falls away in chunks. The man smiles and clears his throat. The man is Walt Disney. 212 years ago, a great marksman in whose symbolic shadow we stand took aim, pulled the trigger, and shot a rabble-rousing nigger. His shot rang out as a foreboding death knell to millions of Negroes living happy as hogs on the tax dollars of hard-working Christian white folks like you and I. Oh, they thought, that go the monthly welfare check. Now he's going to have to go back to robbing chickens from the henhouse. But 50 years later, we rejoice in the marvelous fact that the Negro is no more. 50 years later, we no longer suffer the indignified presence of the blues and jellied pigfoot knuckles that were the Negro's life. 50 years later, we no longer hear the Negro complain he is sadly crippled by the chains of discrimination as he languishes on the urine-stenched street corners of American society, singing doo-wop and swilling from his jar of King Kong corn. 50 years later, we no longer hear the Negro whine he is in exile in his own land as he mounts our naive and trusting daughters who offered up the golden down of their loins in an act of misguided compassion, impregnating her with his evil seed. America found tranquility by laying the Negro to rest. We stripped him of his claim to humanity. We put down his revolt, which threatened to shake the very foundations of our nation. I say to you today, my friends, through the miracle and power of imagination, I wished upon a star and made my dream come true. I wished upon a star that one day this nation would rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. Hang the nigger and burn the Jew. I wished upon a star that one day in a wondrous shopping mall beneath the red hills of Georgia, filled with rides and amusements for the whole family, the sons of former slave owners would dine on the sons of former slaves, secure in the knowledge their silverware was safe from theft. I wished upon a star that one day the content of this nation would be judged by its lack of characters of color. I wish upon a star and made my dream come true. I wish upon a star that one day every coon town would burn to the ground, every jig stop and catfish row made low, the black places made white, up would be down, mice would talk, elephants would fly, and the glory of fantasy land would be revealed, and all of Mickey's friends would see it together. And when the hour of death knelled for the Negro, America became a nation of unsullied whiteness. Negroes burned on the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Negroes burned on the mighty Alleghenies, mighty mountains of New York. Negroes burned on the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Negroes burned on the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Negroes burned on every hill and molehill of Mississippi, on every mountainside, Negroes burn. We let Negroes burn in the stench filled every village and every hamlet, every state and every city, but we didn't care. In our hearts, we thought, let those Negroes burn. Then, one day, the air cleared, and all of Mickey's friends, white men and white women, white boys and white girls, joined hands and sang, paraphrasing the words of that old darky spiritual. Gone at last! Gone at last! Thank God Almighty them niggas is gone at last. Thank you.
Okay, I think there's a lot to react, I'm sure, so we'll start taking any questions that you might have.
Perhaps it's trivial to ask, but where did your initial inspiration for the novel come from, and how long was it in the making?
Basically, it took me 10 years to write. Not like I was working on it constantly, like every day, but I was constantly moving. I didn't really have a place to stay at the time. You know, my father was kicking me out of the house because I didn't have a job and I had to make some money. And I said, no, I'm a writer. I don't want to make all that. The initial inspiration came one afternoon in a village in an apartment in the West Village. I was thinking about these two words, a Negro and phobia. And I put those two words together, and there it was, negrophobia. I looked it up in the dictionary. It existed. In fact, there were pieces written on negrophobia in regards to the antebellum South. The Disney thing was something I had this vision of, this perception of Disney Corporation just co-opting the idea of the imagination, you know. And so I just had this vision of a fascist Disneyland, which I also thought was funny. That was my initial inspiration. We were talking about black exploitation films earlier. I realized just recently that, you know, as we were talking about earlier, you know, growing up with, you know, the racist cartoons and TV shows that were perceived to be racist, like Amos and Andy, you know, was followed by a period where you had, like, very aggressive in obstreperous Negroes in movies, being black exploitation films. And essentially what I did, I realized, was just take those images from the 20s, 30s, and 40s and just move them into the forms of 1970s, you know, which basically was, you know, these sort of black vengeance action films, you know, where we were sticking it to the man. Well, why not Sambo sticking it to the man?
Coffee, and she'll cream you.
Yes, and Aunt Jemima, you know.
Same thing.
those figures, what, you know, seeing those as like Shaft and Superfly and one other, you know. In fact, there was a scene I wrote in Negrophobia that was taken out by my editor that featured Stymie Beard from the Little Rascals as a pimp, right? And, you know, he was running game. The editor, who was female, was highly offended and cut it out. It was put back in the German edition, but you have to read German.
Boy, there's a lot to unpack in that. Was there a question over here?
So you've spent time overseas, and I wonder if you have any thoughts on the question about how much you're addressing, how much of this is unique to America and our history of slavery and Jim Crow and on up through American culture, which has been so influential around the world in many ways, and yet, you know, America's just one part of the world. So I don't know how you see that, sort of looking at it from Germany or from other parts of the world.
That's the answer is like really involved, and I'll try and keep it short. One of the things, you know, which I kind of have to say I was a little offended by was a racist imagery in German film, basically because they didn't have that cultural history. You know, they would do blackface in the film, right? They would do blackface. In fact, there was a film that was done in the 50s. I don't remember the name of it, but it was supposedly of an African village, right? Which basically they shot in the Berlin Zoo. You know, they got some black actors, and there were plenty of black people in Germany, contrary to popular belief, and put them in suits and stuck them in cages. In fact, the first time I visited Vienna, you know, on holiday, I was coming into town when there was like this massive demonstration and this anti-police violence demonstration against the cops because they had murdered a African immigrant in Vienna who was responsible for guarding a mock African village that they had built in the park. Okay, he was supposed to guard, and you would go, you know, this is like the Sunday holiday type thing where you can go and see how the African people live in their huts and things in a park in Vienna, right? This guard was killed. Why was he killed? Whoever was responsible for the park forgot to pay him. Okay. And, you know, people who expect to be paid and are not paid get rather irate. And you're not supposed to display your anger, frustration, that sort of thing in various areas of German society or German-speaking society. You know, very, you know, measured, very, very controlled. They have this very controlled exterior. Underneath, you can find some wonderful things. Sometimes you can find some ugly things. I think racism in Europe is a lot different from racism here because they have a whole other kind of experience with darker peoples, you know. The first time I was in the former East, in the East of Germany, the woman, I went on a flight, you know, there was this airplane club from the old socialist days, and then they took flights, you know, hobby flights around Europe, and we went to the border of Poland. The woman who flew the small craft airplane was convinced I was African. She wouldn't hear, you know, but that was her experience. She wasn't hostile towards me or anything, but, you know, she just kept thinking I was African despite the fact that I spoke English and nothing else. As an American black, I was welcomed, for the most part, by the Germans. If I were African, that would have been an entirely different story. They claimed this had to do with, I don't remember what it was called, but they did this airlift, Berlin airlift, where they dropped like
food supplies, things like that. Yeah.
Yeah, and the Germans were very grateful, so they tended to treat Americans well. That's interesting. No, because I was thinking about that, and the night I was on a bus, and there were some Turks, you know, saying like bad things about me, because I was an American. Bush had just blown up Iraq or something, and my girlfriend at the time happened to be German Arab, and so she spoke Arabic, and she like explained to them in Arabic that I might be an American, but I didn't necessarily support Bush, blah blah blah. When I got into situations like that, because there was a lot of like animosity towards Americans because of the Iraq war and, you know, American policy, war policies, stuff like that, I would simply look at them and say, Elvis or George Bush, who do you think is a real American, right? And after that, they would leave me alone because, you know, Elvis rules, right?
I'm just interested in hearing how the publication of that book came about. Did you have to shop it around? Did you have an agent? Did publishers beg you to be able to publish the book?
No. This was, in terms of how I've learned how to do things, best way to go about getting yourself published is to go to parties, book parties, magazine parties, and you schmooze with editors. You make contacts. You do like readings where you think magazine editors might be, and the magazine editor might be impressed with your reading and will invite you to lunch. And then over lunch, you talk about possible story ideas you could write for the publication. Or you meet a book editor. Again, go to lunch. And you talk about the possibility of publishing your book. I was at a Christmas party that was at Michael O'Donoghue's house. And at the party, I fell into conversation with a writer named George Tro and Sean Wallace. Sean Wallace was the son of the founder of the original publisher of The New Yorker. George wrote for The New Yorker. And George seemed to be impressed by the fact that I knew who he was. And he said that he knew someone who might be interested in my book when I told him I had written this novel. And he introduced me to, oh God, I can't remember his name right now. But he introduced me to this editor. The editor looked at it, went to his publisher, his bosses, and say we can get this book really cheap, blah, 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 and the rest is history. Yes, they did. And I got a rather big payment on the back end because of that.
You said earlier that you knew Ishmael Reed.
Yes.
Did you know William Burroughs? And if so, do you have any anecdotal stories or anything?
I met William Burroughs in the flesh. I met William Burroughs in the flesh at a book signing. I interviewed him once via telephone while he was living in Lawrence, Kansas, on the occasion of Terry Southern's passing, because he and Terry Southern were quite close. What can I tell you about Burroughs? that few people might not know. He was deeply interested in magic. In fact, a lot of the contemporary cultists read Burroughs for insight into magical technique. Burroughs had a specific, very specific way of talking, which he also considered, you know, which he considered a magical exercise. I can't tell you, because I don't know parts of speech.
Well, it was very incantatory, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was like a drone almost.
Yeah.
Kind of, yeah.
I can tell you from my experiments that are similar, they're similar to Burroughs' cut-up technique, which actually, from what I understand, was a technique that was taken from this woman who was a poet who's living out in Berkeley. I don't remember her name again, and I'm sorry. This is the technique that, you know, that I've been working with recently is called dream splicing. What I discovered, you know, because I do a lot of meditation, seated meditation, I started keeping a journal of what happens in waking life, what happens in dream life, and what happens when I'm meditating. And after a period of time, I noticed that my consciousness in dream, waking life, and in meditation all seem like the same reality. And as an experiment, I started splicing the dream content of my journals into my waking journals. Was for me an interesting literary effect, especially if I wrote it in such a way you couldn't tell the dream from the waking stuff. Now, to trigger the ideas that are in these dream splicing texts is that I read it aloud in public. I discovered all of this by accident. I happened to read a piece I read a piece that I did like this in public, and I noticed like a noticeable change in the atmosphere in the room, and the way people responded. That's the best part of the writing experience for me, is to orally share what I do with an audience. And very often it has been a magical experience, just in terms of being able to affect an audience's point of view, how they perceive, lead them to certain things, and to notice a real change, I mean, a visible change in atmosphere, something kind of electric, and I hope that was clear.
Okay, I think, I think that's a good place to end, actually. Thank you, Mr. James, and thank you for coming.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, Information on the series is available at freelibrary.org.